This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today is the 20th anniversary of Roe v. Wade, the Supreme Court decision that guaranteed a woman's right to abortion. President Clinton used the occasion to lift the restrictions on abortion counseling at federally funded clinics. He also lifted bans on fetal tissue research and abortion in military hospitals overseas. He's reviewing the importation ban on the abortion pill RU486. We'll be hearing from activists who support and oppose abortion rights. Jean Hunt has been active in the women's health movement since the late 60s. She's a registered nurse. From 1988 to 92, she directed the Elizabeth Blackwell Healthcare Center for Women in Philadelphia, which provides abortions. She applauds the president for the executive orders he issued today. I asked her to think back 20 years to the day abortion was legalized.
When the decision came in, I was thrilled. I was overjoyed that we had won what seemed like a monumental victory, and very much out of my own personal history. I came to the age of sexual activity in the 50s and the 60s, and it was a time of terror for me as a young person, even though I was middle class. And I never shook that terror, really, until 1973. Never felt comfortable in my body. The other thing that happened, though, was that a friend of mine, Rachel Fruchter, who was an activist in the movement in New York, said to us at that time, "We're going to rue the day that we won this victory through the Supreme Court." And I had no idea what she was talking about. And I said, "What are you talking about, Rachel? We've won." She said, "We didn't win by building a movement state by state that demanded this. We didn't do the work that we needed to do to win this. It was handed to us." And she was right.
I'm sure a lot of women who support the right to abortion feel that the battle might be kind of won now, in the sense that the Supreme Court has decided not to overturn Roe v. Wade, and there's a pro-choice president now, President Clinton. Do you feel that that the battle is won, that the battle is over?
Well, let me say a couple things about this, Terry. First of all, this is a battle. It is about women, but it's also about families, and families have women and men in them. That's the first thing. The second thing is that we've won something by the court's decision on the Pennsylvania case. We've won a basic affirmation, and the court gave some very good language, which I know Kitty Colbert has talked to you about our right to bodily integrity. But at the same time, the court has the rule that we say is it's never met a regulation it didn't like around abortion. And the reality of these regulations is that they are designed to drive providers out of the business of providing abortion services. And I think what people have to understand is that even if we win the legal right, and even if we have a positive regulatory climate in Washington, the medical service of abortion has vanished from the American medical system, and that the anti-abortion movement has won an enormous victory, and it's a done deed unless we right now reverse that trend. And that is much more disturbing to me, because what it means is that the range of healthcare services we need as women in order to stay healthy and to be able to have the children that we want to have is not there.
So abortion remains legal, but it's really difficult to get.
In 83% of the counties of the United States, there is no abortion provider. So the legal right is an empty victory. It's a hollow victory if you live in a county where there is no one who can provide the service for you in a safe and legal manner.
Are there fewer doctors performing abortion now than there were a few years ago?
There are many fewer doctors performing abortion, and abortion has increasingly become a segregated service, a segregated medical service. It now exists on the far edges of the healthcare system, as if it had nothing to do with anything else having to do with women's healthcare. There are almost no physicians routinely getting trained in OBGYN residencies. I believe the figure is 12% of OBGYN residencies mandate training in abortion procedures for students going through those residencies. When I came to Blackwell in the fall of 1988, we had four physicians working with us providing abortion services. In the late fall of 1988, I fired one of them. He had excellent technical skills, but had poor attitudes about women, and we felt that he was not respectful enough of the women coming through the center. I regretted firing him very much in a very short period of time, because we no longer had the luxury to demand that attitude be a category by which we measure physicians. We were lucky to get physicians with good technical skills, which was the bottom line.
What's the problem? Why are there so few doctors performing abortion now?
I think it's a very complex problem. I think the most obvious piece of it is that physicians are afraid. In many, many communities, they are targeted by a very small number of residents of that community, and their lives can be made miserable, as are the lives of their children, their spouses, their friends, and their families. So that the first thing is that the perception is, and in many towns the reality is, that if you're going to do abortion, you have to be willing to stand up and take a lot of heat. We on the pro-choice side, on the other hand, have not supported physicians who do abortions. We have not gone out of our way to say thank you for providing this piece of women's health care to the physicians that we see. We don't ask our gynecologists, do you provide abortion services? And if you don't, why don't you? We don't choose our gynecologists on the basis of this. The anti-abortion movement has been doing this for now for 20 years.
In your experience, in during the 4 years that you headed the Elizabeth Blackwell Healthcare Center for Women, did you see doctors who performed abortions harassed? And were you personally harassed for heading the center?
Oh, I was harassed extensively, and the center was harassed extensively. All of us, not just the executive director and the physicians, but the counselors, the lab techs, the students who work with us on weekends, all of us faced tremendous. There were smoke bombs. There were bomb threats. There were letters coming in on a regular basis telling us that we were going to die, our families were going to die.
I want to get back to the difficulty that you had hiring a doctor to replace the doctor that you fired. What was the problem and how did you go about finding someone?
Well, I'll tell you some of the things that I did. I sent personal letters to every graduating OBGYN resident of three local medical schools in Philadelphia outlining the problem, explaining that if they were pro-choice, they might consider working with us on a part-time basis, begging them for help. I got not one response. I spoke at Grand Rounds and directly to OBGYN residents at several medical schools. I spoke to the heads of OBGYN departments at several medical schools in the region asking for assistance. Got nowhere. I ran ads in the New York Times. I ran ads in the Inquirer. I got one response in the New York Times from a physician who, when he found out that I wanted to do a credentialing process, explore his credentials and his capability, he dropped out immediately. He clearly thought that just because I ran an abortion facility, I'd be willing to take any old anybody into the center, which was never the case and never will be the case.
Did you find someone?
No.
Really?
No.
So you're down one.
We're down to two physicians. And we worry very much that if either of them leaves, we would not be able to replace them.
My guest is Jean Hunt, former director of the Elizabeth Blackwell Healthcare Center for Women in Philadelphia. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Healthcare activist Jean Hunt is my guest. The center that you directed for 4 years was the target of many anti-abortion demonstrations. I'd like you to describe one of those demonstrations, one of the more dramatic ones, in which you tried to keep the healthcare center open, to keep services operating, in spite of the protests.
They almost always would come without warning, so that we would arrive at the center, or workers would arrive at the center and find that the doors were blockaded. The police historically are very slow at clearing the center. It would sometimes take 2 to 3 hours. It seemed to me that most of these protests took place on freezing cold days in the driving rain. The center staff would be out on the street through that whole process. Many of the anti-abortion demonstrators are really kind of unhinged. There's something in them, I don't exactly understand it, why a grown man would fall to his knees weeping to a 22-year-old woman, "Mommy, mommy, don't murder me, mommy." There's some loss of boundary here that doesn't make much sense to me. There was a very unpleasant racial dynamic. The protesters were almost always white. Most of them, we know from doing a study, were from outside of Philadelphia. Many of the women coming to our center were Black and Hispanic. The men accompanying their women, their wives, or their girlfriends into the center were very often the targets of quite racist attacks. "Be a real man. You're not a real man. If you were a real man, you'd raise up your child." It always was amazing to me that families did not respond with violence to these very violent and provocative attacks upon their personhood and their dignity. When we would finally get the center open, what people don't understand is that then the day begins for the center staff. And then you have a group of very angry and very upset consumers that are there for a service, all determined to go forward with it. Anybody that gets turned away during a blockade who doesn't come in that day, our experience was almost always they would come back the next day or the next available appointment. Nobody's mind was ever changed in any kind of permanent way because they would go back to their lives. And they would go back into the situation which led them to make this decision in the first place.
Now, the center that you headed is in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. The Pennsylvania restrictive abortion law was upheld by the Supreme Court in 1992. How did that law affect you?
Well, the law hasn't yet been implemented, but if it was implemented, we were very concerned about our future ability to provide care for a couple of reasons. One was that the law mandated that physicians have to do the counseling for abortions, and we're having trouble getting physicians to come in and do the surgery. Physicians are historically not great counselors. When you go through medical school, you don't learn a lot about how to do counseling. So there were two problems with this. One is that we would have to find a physician willing to come in and do the counseling and pay him or her a very high, you know, amount of money to get them to do this piece, which they weren't that interested in doing. And then we would have to turn around and do the counseling again to be sure that women were adequately counseled and adequately listened to. So that was going to create a tremendous both administrative and financial burden for us. And I tried to cost it out a number of times. I never could really do it because I wasn't exactly sure what the final regulations would look like. But I knew that it was going to dramatically increase the cost of the procedure. Likewise, on the 24-hour wait, it was going to add a lot of administrative and bureaucratic detail to our functioning, which wasn't going to guarantee better health for women or better services for women. It was really designed to be an obstacle. Again, it would drive up costs and make it much more difficult for us to take care of the same number of women, which is what I think it was intended to do.
I want to paraphrase something that you recently said. You said that you're tired of people who see the middle ground on the abortion issue as being this, that abortion remains legal, but it's very, very difficult to get.
I think the middle ground on the abortion question and where we ought to be moving is to make abortion absolutely available and accessible and then cut down the need for it. To me, it makes much more sense rather than to create a right and say, here it is, but you have to swim through sharks and jump over barbed wire fences to get this right. Let's make it possible for women not to need it. We do more abortions in this country than in any other industrialized nation of the world. There is no reason that we should be doing this many, and we only do it because of the failure of our public health care system to adequately address women's health care needs. And this is one area where I think we in the anti-abortion movement ought to join forces.
You had to deal with the business end of abortion. What were some of the problems you ran up against heading the Women's Health Care Center in balancing the books?
Well, as a nonprofit healthcare center which focused on providing extensive counseling and support to women, there were a lot of services we provided that nobody will pay for. You know, when you get paid for an abortion by Blue Cross or by an HMO, there's no money in that for counseling. There's money for the physician, there's money for the lab tests, there's money for the lights and the heat and the medical supplies, but that's it. We see it as a broader problem than just a surgical intervention in someone's life. We see it as something where people need counseling and support. They need post-abortion care. They need access to family planning services. They may raise other questions in the course of their care which require social services intervention. So there was no funding for any of that.
Have a lot of abortion clinics been forced to close because of financial problems?
Yes, I think that even in the time that I was at Blackwell, clinics were closing and physicians were going out of practice. And one of the major things is that physicians who came into this in the early 70s and began to do abortions did it because what they saw when they were residents, when abortion was illegal. A lot of the physicians who came to providing the service came to it out of a real drive that this shouldn't have to happen to women. Those physicians are gray and they're retiring. And they struggle to find young physicians who want to learn what they have to teach, and they can't find them. That's the first and major problem. The second is that a lot of pieces of what is required, for instance, insurance regulations, et cetera, insurance companies are increasingly less and less willing to insure us. Our insurance rates go up. So this whole combination, this whole package, combined with the day-to-day harassment of the staff by anti-abortion people and the fear that comes sometimes, makes you have to be pretty dedicated in order to hang in there.
I thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Jean Hunt is a healthcare consultant and the former director of the Elizabeth Blackwell Healthcare Center for Women in Philadelphia. The Roe v. Wade ruling 20 years ago turned my next guest, Dr. Mildred Jefferson, into an activist. She's former president of the National Right to Life Committee and current president of Right to Life Crusade. Dr. Jefferson is a general surgeon with Boston University Medical Center and an assistant clinical professor of surgery at Boston University School of Medicine. She was the first African-American woman to graduate from Harvard Medical School. This is her most vivid memory of 20 years ago, the day a woman's right to abortion was guaranteed by the Supreme Court.
I remember very well what I was doing. I was actually playing with my dogs. And my father, who is now dead, told me that he had heard news on the radio that he simply could not believe. My father was a Methodist minister who had never in his entire life mentioned the word abortion to me. And he said, if he heard it correctly, the United States Supreme Court had made abortion the law of the land. And he could not believe that.
Let me just ask you the year that you co-founded Right to Life.
It was 1973. National Right to Life Committee came into being as a national organization in June of 1973 in Detroit. Almost all right-to-life activity in the United States has come about as a response to pro-abortion promotion. And I emphasize right-to-life because as you led in, you mentioned anti-abortion movement. I am not an anti-abortionist. I am a defender of the right to life and a defender of the sanctity of life and the Judeo-Christian ethical and moral tradition as the basis of the laws and customs of our country.
Now that Bill Clinton is the president and Bill Clinton is pro-choice, how does that affect the direction of your group, the Right to Life Crusade, and the tactics that your group will use?
It will not change the tactic of Right to Life Crusade because we have understood from the very beginning that the White House was the forum that had to be protected. And it is because many parts of the rest of the movement did not see it in quite the same importance that we don't have it today. However, I would hope the one change that might be possible is taking advantage of what the new Chief of Staff, McLarty, had to say about creating access for all points of view. So far, there has not been any sign that I can see that there is an understanding that there is another point of view. Throughout the presidential campaign, even though Right to Life protesters appeared everywhere candidate Clinton appeared, that was not covered in the news. So it's unlikely that he himself was aware of how consistently there was the attempt to get the message across.
There are many doctors who perform abortions who have been harassed and who have been harassed even by death threats. And these kinds of threats have driven many doctors away from performing abortions and have prevented many doctors from starting it in the first place. As a doctor yourself, do you approve of tactics that threaten doctors with their lives?
There is no evidence of any kind that I have seen or heard credible that has tied anyone in the Right to Life movement with any death threat to a doctor. That's contrary to anything that would be done from the Right to Life movement. However, when you consider what business abortion is and the fact that there may be not only commercial competitions but underworld ties, I think they lead to look in a different direction. The Right to Life movement has very active people who in the direct action movement. And they do go, shall we say, to very direct action and trying to let those doctors who do abortion know that they object and are trying to save the lives of those children.
I myself recommend
and would draw the line at anything that would look as if the individual was in any way endangered. And I don't believe that anyone in the Right to Life movement would act to the point of endangering any individual.
One of the tactics of demonstrators who have tried to prevent women from entering abortion clinics is to smoke bomb the clinics, stink bomb the clinics, and to surround the clinics so that women wanting abortions can't enter.
I don't know of any of the direct action movements of the Right to Life movement carrying on that kind of tactic. And I would suggest that if you can ever find out who has done these things, you're going to find something like the situation in California, where it was someone from the pro-abortion side attempting to discredit the pro-life direct activists in that gesture. The Operation Rescue adherents are the ones who are placing their bodies on the ground in front of the clinic doors. They are the ones who are chained by the kryptonite locks to those vehicles that are blocking the roads to the clinic. They are the ones in danger of their lives, and many of them have been injured by rough handling of those who are trying to get them out of the way.
Many doctors have spoken of how they saw the damages of illegal abortions, and that convinced them of the necessity of safe, legal abortion. I'm wondering if you've seen that during your medical career and what effect it's had on you.
Well, I wish the same doctors would follow the patients that are being operated on now under the so-called legal auspices and see how happy they would be then with today's circumstance. Because when you consider 4,400 women undergoing abortion every single day in this country, you know that they are not getting the kind of medical care and supervision they need. They're not getting the kind of follow-up they need. We are creating a generation of gynecologic cripples, and they are closing their eyes to this. I've always heard the experience quoted by the people you're referring to, and I found that they tended to greatly exaggerate the complications of the procedures that they referred to as, quote, illegal, and they have greatly minimized the deaths and complications that occur now. I don't find that a suitable way of evaluating medical and surgical circumstances.
Dr. Mildred Jefferson is president of Right to Life Crusade and a surgeon with Boston University Medical Center. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.